Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and yep, first show of the year. I had a great break. I just relaxed at home. There was no traveling, really. There was a bit of time at the beach with Mrs. Biz and Baby Biz. There was a little bit of camping. But yeah, if I was any more relaxed, I'd be in a coma. It was terrific. And yeah, we're going to have a chat with Adam Boileau shortly about the news we missed while we were on break. And surprisingly, nothing really earth-shattering happened while I was off on break, which is unusual. But certainly some interesting stuff happened, so we'll be talking about all of that in just a moment. This week's show is brought to you by Cylance. Big thanks to them for that. And yeah, some of you may have heard BlackBerry announced that it's acquiring or has acquired Cylance for $1.4 billion. I don't know if that's closed yet, but it's great news for all of the founders and early employees there. So congratulations to them. Some of them I know reasonably well. So congrats to Team Cylance on that. But yeah, we're not talking about that this week. Instead, Cylance's very own Scott Schefferman will join us to talk about the MITRE ATT&CK framework and how it's informing their product dev. And you know, there's some product talk in that interview, but there's also some real meat there. So I let that interview run long. Scott says we're close, and this is a really interesting part, actually. Scott says we're close to this terrible situation where security companies are going to start using MITRE ATT&CK as a marketing tool, like, you know, full MITRE ATT&CK coverage with a tick, you know. So that's a little bit depressing, but there's a lot of good stuff in that chat, and it is coming up after the news. But first up, of course, it is time for a check on recent security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, welcome back to Risky Biz for 2019. Did you have a nice break?
I also had a nice break, and I'm also pretty relaxed after a couple of weeks of not thinking about computer hacking. But yeah, I guess the world still needs things to get owned and wrecked, and here we are to discuss the things that have gone wrong.
It's funny, you know, I'm on Twitter at the moment. You know, I'm back on Twitter in full force this week, and everyone's just being so relaxed and happy, and, you know, great start to 2019. Not sure how long it's going to last, but we did have a few what I would describe as major stories kick off over the break, and one of them was this situation in Germany where a whole bunch of politicians had their email and personal accounts compromised. Is that correct?
Yeah, some guy owned a bunch of political accounts. There seemed to be a variety of different accounts that got owned, and then was dropping them on Twitter, like sort of like an advent calendar, of leaks every day leading up to Christmas. It kind of puttered along for a little while until it, picked up steam relatively late in the month. Because this particular set of leaks covered, you know, the full set of German political parties except for the really right-wing one, there was, you know, oh, this is politically motivated. And we're not, 100% clear what the motivation is. And then, of course, the finger pointed at Russia.
Right? Like, it's the style right now.
Well, exactly, right, yeah. Some German authorities went as far as saying, you know, APT-28, the Fancy Bear crew were responsible. And then the story developed, and it turns out that there is some, 19, 20-year-old dude in Germany who has confessed to doing it and has been arrested and is cooperating with the authorities, and it wasn't Russia after all.
There you go. German, right, extreme right-wing Germans, what could go wrong, right?
It's been
interesting to see the difference in the way this is handled as opposed to the way, you know, American media handled the Podesta and DNC leaks where they just, you know, set their staff on mining them. And, you know, you had opposition parties, seizing on nuggets that they found. And then, of course, that would kick off a news cycles of denials and clarifications. Doesn't look like that's really happened in this instance. In Germany.
No, there seems to be, a bit more, attempt of restraint or of not overly publicizing the material. There was a few papers in Germany that, seized on it pretty early on and had published, say, screenshots of the guy's Twitter that had subsequently been deleted, but that there was, live links to the material in there. And there's a bit of kind of chastising of that a bit more respectful approach to it. Although one of the things that was interesting about this leak is this, this particular guy had done quite a lot of groundwork to stop the material from being taken down. Like, he'd been, mirroring the material over the place. I think Grok did some analysis, and there was, 70 different mirrors or something of the material. So, like, that seemed like quite a lot of work. And, because we don't know the full details of what the guy did yet, it's not clear, whether this was done, individual attacks, or whether, he compromised some service that happened to be shared and then password reused, shared by a number of people in German government and then password reused elsewhere. We don't really know what the methodology was, but it's clearly pretty effective.
And where did they get this stuff from? I mean, did it come from personal accounts or did it come from, government systems? Do we know that?
Well, no, we don't. It seemed to be a real mishmash of things. And that's, you know, one of the bits that, you know, because it kind of got squashed pretty quickly, we don't, I mean, I don't really know what the, you know, what services it all came from. So, yeah, I'm sure it'll come out in the wash exactly what happened, especially now that he is cooperating.
Yeah. I wonder if this is because, you know, we've learned that lesson from the 2016 stuff that happened in the United States, or if maybe Germany's just culturally a little bit different to the United States, you know?
Yeah, it's hard to say, and we're going to, you know, we'll see what the fallout is, but, you know, everyone who pointed the finger at Russia right off the bat, I guess, has a little bit of Russian egg on their face.
It didn't quite feel like that. I remember, you know, because I was on holiday, but I was still sort of watching stuff, and I just thought, no, this... You know, one thing that sort of tipped it is apparently, like, the leaks started for quite a while before anyone noticed. And I thought, no, if it was done by someone organized, like, they would have done a better job of, you know, making it known that there was juicy, juicy stuff up for grabs. Now, another thing that happened while we were on break is a bunch of newspapers in the United States had their operations severely disrupted by, you know, what was initially described as a ransomware attack. And I think LA Times reported that it was like a foreign actor was involved. But this just looks like maybe a fairly typical ransomware infection, or do we not know yet?
I mean, the only reporting we've seen so far says ransomware, you know, attributes it to a specific strangled Ryuk ransomware that's been used in some other cases for, you know, for extortion, for making money out of ransomware, as opposed to, you know, mayhem causing. It's a little bit complicated because it was the a bunch of back office systems from the Tribune, which previously owned some of the, you know, papers like the LA Times, and then some of those shared systems were still in place, and that ended up, you know, disrupting publication. We don't really know, like, how widespread it was, and yeah, it could well be, you know, a bunch of stuff just was running old unpatched Windows, and a piece of, you know, ransomware managed to get into that particular network through, you know, normal.
It's kind of an Occam's razor thing, right? Like, at this point.
Well, yeah, and I mean, in the end, you know, in impacted production, it's not clear that they paid any money to the people who were doing it, or whether that was even possible, you know, whether the payment system was actually functional in this case. But yeah, we don't really know. The net result was a bunch of newspapers got delayed in production in the US, but we don't know a whole bunch more about that. And I mean, the attribution thing really has been, you know, oh, well, foreigners were involved. Well, I mean, you know, it could be an IP from anywhere in the world. I mean, who knows, right? There isn't really anything strong there.
We've also seen a report. This one comes to us via Motherboard, but it's based off an Amnesty International report. But it looks really about how crews are now bypassing basic 2FA or one-time password-based 2FA via SMS or code generators. You know, that's sort of becoming standard now. This seems to be a thing that we can say. I'm not really... I get that it's news that people are actually doing this now, but sort of, you know, one-time password pass-through attacks are not exactly new.
No, from a technical perspective, I mean, this is a pretty straightforward thing. I mean, proxying onwards to the real authentication service and then also doing the second factor auth, you know, via SMS or from a, you know, code generation app or something. You know, that's a thing that people have been doing for some time. And yeah, we're seeing it in this case, you know, targeting journalists and that kind of thing, which I suppose is what's news here. People who have taken the first step of having any sort of two factor. And now we have to kind of recommunicate with everybody that, you know, yes, that two factor bought you a couple of years. Now you need to move to something that actually isn't phishable through that kind of password technique, you know, like a YubiKey or like the Google branded YubiKey equivalent, whatever that's called, Titan. Yeah. That Google was giving out, yeah, for their advanced, you know, accounts protection stuff that actually prevents this kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, it bought us a little while, so that's good. But yeah, people are obviously getting this technique pretty polished.
Well, apparently hundreds of people in the Middle East, activists mostly, were presented with fake login pages, and, you know, those pages were set up to capture OTP. So that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing it used, you know, in a weaponized manner by, you know, by who knows, I guess. I mean, the sort of people who'd like to target human rights activists in the Middle East, which doesn't really make it for a very short list, unfortunately. Mm. But yeah, seeing it used in the wild, you know, it's just time for people to move onwards to, you know, hardware security tokens.
Yeah, we had a funny one here in Australia where some emergency warning system that I've never heard of got owned, and, you know, attackers were using it to send messages.
Yeah, this reads like someone just got their credentials guessed or, you know, reused from some leak somewhere, and there was a single factor, you know, web-based login portal for this particular emergency notification network that no one's heard of. The funny thing was that the messages that were sent out were basically saying, that this particular thing had been hacked and your personal data, i.e. the numbers for the emergency warning system, were not safe, which doesn't seem like a particularly, you know, thing that doesn't seem a thing that most people would be worried about, I guess. But, you know, given, you know, the discussion about security and privacy in Australia lately, perhaps it was kind of topical. But, yeah, I don't think anything of value was owned here.
Well, I think it's good that, you know, it wasn't some idiot who decided to broadcast a tsunami warning or something like that, right? Like, of all of the possible messages that someone could have sent, that seems to be a pretty reasonable one. Not that I would advocate, you know, doing that type of unauthorized testing necessarily. I think this story is more interesting than it first appears. Okay, we're going to talk about cryptocurrencies, apologies, right? But some time ago, you remember when there was the hack of the DAO, right? And Ethereum had to hard fork because so many people lost their money, right? So most people like went with the hard fork and you know, that became Ethereum. And what was left over became known as Ethereum Classic, right? Which in market cap terms is like much, much shorter, smaller than Ethereum. Now, yeah, as everybody knows, cryptocurrency values have really reduced, shall we say, and that has sort of stripped some of the incentive away from people to participate in these mining pools. So we've actually seen a successful double spend attack against Ethereum Classic, and I think people got away with about $500,000 in this instance. And the reason I think this is interesting is because as the values keep plummeting, I think you're going to see more and more cryptocurrencies being vulnerable to these types of attacks, which of course rely on the attacker being able to muster more CPU, you know, resources in aggregate than the legit mining pool. What did you think of this?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously it's funny to laugh at the crypto people getting robbed yet again. But yeah, you make a very good point, right? I mean, this particular attack, against kind of a backwater cryptocurrency,
we're going to get mail, but go on.
But that doesn't command the resource or the respect to get enough mining people. Some of the analysis that I've seen suggested that something like maybe less than $10,000, like $5,000 worth of compute time would be necessary to compete with and have 51% of the mining pool in this particular case, and to then carry out the double spending attack, which is, it seems to be what they did over a period number of days. They entered a whole bunch of extra machines into the mining system, took over, published fake blocks that allowed them to double spend. And actually, a couple more updated analyses do seem to suggest something like $1 million, or double what was previously estimated, was double spent before it got spotted. And of course, it was also spotted by some of the exchanges, not by the people who actually run Ethereum Classic, which is a bit embarrassing for them as well. But yeah, you make a really good point, right? I mean, the people who are no longer mining because it's not economical, there's a bunch of people who've got, general purpose mining hardware and big pools of equipment that's sitting around not making money. And then there's, the splintering of cryptocurrencies where there's just, thousands of cryptocurrencies and the pool of, the amount of people who are willing to, spend time and hardware doing computation is, split up.
And you don't need those resources for very long, right? This is an ephemeral thing. You only need to hold 51% of the pool for a very short period of time.
Yes, exactly, right? And where the economics of it makes sense, right? I mean, if we take the numbers on face value that we've seen so far, like if you get $1 million for a $5,000 investment, yeah, that starts to make a lot of sense.
And if they have to spend, $1 million a week, say, right? And you just have to spend like $200,000 in a day to get a few million out, right? Like this is the thing, the economics, when it comes to like this type of ephemeral attack, like an attack that relies on just ephemeral resources, it gets cost effective pretty quickly if you're looking at a sort of, vulnerable backwater cryptocurrency.
Yeah, exactly right. And I mean, this is one of the reasons why, all of the really marginal cryptocurrencies are going to have to die in order that a couple of strong ones can survive.
Cleansing fire.
Yeah, and that's what's doing, that's what's going on. And I guess, whoever it was that, if you did in fact make off with $1 million worth of cryptocurrency and you managed to get it out of that ecosystem, then yeah, I guess you're doing your part. So sure.
Yeah, right. That's very Ayn Randian of you. That's interesting. I think that's one of my predictions for 2019 is we're going to see more of these. What do you reckon?
Yeah, probably. And I think, you know, obviously, yeah, we'll see it against, you know, a bunch of the smaller ones. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised, you know, with so many people bowing out, that we do start to see it, you know, with real big money.
Yeah. Joe Cox has a great story up at Motherboard where they put their money where their mouth was, forked out $300 and, you know, paid some rando to locate their cell phone, and they were able to do that. So that's pretty interesting. Basically, you can spend $300 and locate anyone's cell phone in the US. And this, of course, is because of these weird relationships telcos there have with data brokers.
Yeah, we've, you know, we covered this, I guess, towards second half of last year, where there was a bit of palaver about that company that was selling service to like law enforcement to go look up people's locations for monitoring bail conditions and things, and that, you know, led to, you know, a bunch of hue and cry in the US, and, you know, the phone company saying they were going to clamp down on this type of data sharing. And yeah, Joseph's been pretty good at pulling the thread between the various, you know, organizations involved, and it's a different set of organizations than the previous reporting that we saw. In this case, you know, like a couple of third-party data aggregators that are buying data from the phone companies and then selling it, and eventually, in this case, ending up with, you know, bounty hunters and bail bondsmen and all of the other kind of, you know, amazing things that the, you know, the foremost free society in the world has. But yeah, I mean, the net result is you can still just locate any phone in the US, you know, by paying a trivial amount of money. I
love to tease Joseph about the fact that he doesn't actually have a phone. He just uses an iPod Touch for everything. But then you read something like this and you're like, huh.
Maybe he's got a point.
He's got a point, you know. So there you go. The European Union is going to fund bug bounty programs for 14 open source projects starting from this month, which is interesting. But I saw this proposal getting a little bit of flack online from people like Katie Masouris, who knows a thing or two about bug bounties, saying, well, you know, are you going to also give funding to the maintainers to fix the bugs? Because that would seem to be a bit of a missing piece that a lot of people ignore.
Yeah, I mean, that is a very good point. I mean, obviously, anything that gets some security eyes on key bits of software, and we are talking about some pretty, you know, reasonable things like, you know, libc, PuTTY, for example, you know, pretty widely used piece of software. You know, having those things have more eyes is really good, and, you know, funding open source projects to have this kind of review or have, you know, bug bounty reviews done is really good. But of course, you're right. I mean, we then are going to expect the developers who already do it for free or as part of their other, you know, their other work to then go and fix the bugs for free. And we have seen some previous bug bounty programs, you know, say you also have to commit a patch, you know, or provide a patch.
Yeah, but that feels like, I don't know, that doesn't feel like a great idea to me.
Well, because, you know, hackers are not great developers. I mean, being able to find and exploit a bug doesn't mean you can fix
There's the issue of trust as well, right?
Like, well, that too, yes.
But would you want Ben Hawks getting commit rights into your project, right?
Well, I mean, you know, maybe Ben's a specific case, but I can think of other
examples. I mean like Evil Ben.
Evil Ben, yes.
Evil Ben, you wouldn't. Good Ben, you would, you know.
So. Yeah, good Ben's totes fine.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, Katie making some good points there. But I also feel like let's not harsh out too much. Let's wait and see what the results of the bounties are before we start screaming at them to fund maintainers, right? So, you know, if there are projects that need extra help there, you know, maybe someone needs to write a grant proposal at that point, you know? So, like, baby steps. Another thing that blew up, and there was a lot of dud reporting on this, from what I can tell, is there was this story about hackers hijacking thousands of Chromecasts to warn people about a security bug, and then everyone was like, oh, it's a UPnP thing, and then other people were saying, no, it's not a UPnP thing, people put their Chromecasts on the internet. What happened here? Like, I've got no idea.
So I think this is a combination of two things. Like, one is if you're on the local network with a Chromecast, you can essentially talk to it without effective authentication, or at least
because that's what they're supposed to do,
which is how it's supposed to work, right? And then that, you know, that was a kind of a known thing. That plus UPnP, where you are exposing those bits of the Chromecasts out to the internet, either directly, which I don't know why you would do that, or inadvertently through UPnP, which I think is what's happening here. And then yeah, someone went and, you know, scanned or asked showed. And for all of those, and started sending, you know, YouTube videos about PewDiePie or whatever to lots of people's Chromecasts, which, you know, apparently is a thing that we do these days. I don't know, but yeah, the reporting got a little bit weird because I don't know, you know, hackers are in your TV kind of thing. But you know, yet more UPnP shenanigans from some of the same people who've been doing it against printers and things for much the same, you know, YouTube advertising purposes.
Where did I get this idea that UPnP might not have been an angle here?
So there was some discussion on the Twitters about whether or not the UPnP was involved, whether or not it was like some ISP that had been pre-configuring their routers in a particular way, or whether, you know, it was attacks against UPnP that were then opening up internal things, like we saw towards the end of last year. But it's all a little bit unclear because, I mean, it kind of wrapped up pretty quickly. And yeah, there was lots of chit-chat on Twitter about exactly the specifics of what these attackers were doing. But yeah, it's a little bit murky.
TLDR, disable UPnP, and you won't have to watch PewDiePie videos.
Well, that seems like a pretty good combination, though. UPnP, no PewDiePie. Good choice.
Excellent. Apparently, parties unknown have stolen the personal information of 1,000 North Korean defectors from the South Korean government. Is that correct?
Ah, geez. Yeah, this is, I think, like some regional service that supported defectors from North Korea and South Korea, and they got their either their website or their database or something owned. It wasn't clear exactly, you know, in what form the data was stolen, but, you know, obviously people who've defected from North Korea into South Korea is a particularly vulnerable group, I suppose, that, you know, if this is the North Koreans doing it, which, you know, let's say the incentives probably aligned there, like that's just not a great place to be. For those defectors and, of course, their families back home in North Korea. So, yeah, just not great.
No, really not. So, yay. Now, we got this really awesome bit of research and building from Trammell Hudson. This was presented recently. This is like a recreation of the theoretical attacks proposed by Bloomberg. Well, I mean, they didn't describe them as theoretical. They described them as actual, but we're just going to say that they were theoretical attacks. This guy's tried to recreate these types of hardware implants. And he's come up with some really interesting stuff here. Really, really interesting.
Yeah, this is a totally great talk from 35C3, where he kind of starts with the Bloomberg story, says, okay, let's accept it as fact, you know, whether or not it happened, you know, I don't know. Let's start from there and go, can I actually implement this? And he got hold of a bunch of boards that are, you know, similar, similar Supermicro, similar server class boards, and then goes through the process of implementing an attack that could do what's described, you know, within the space and the board and the installation constraints. And he makes a pretty reasonable argument that, you know, you're not going to do this to all the boards in the factory. You're going to do it through, you know, interdiction of specific boards and replace components. And he comes up with an attack whereby by replacing what looks like, you know, a tiny resistor on one of the serial data lines from the flash to the baseboard controller, come up with a system that can gain code exec on the baseband management controller from those constraints, and actually does it. In this case, he built an FPGA implementation of his thing, and also, you know, an emulated software version, that, you know, modifies the bits being loaded out of the flash on the way past. And it's a particularly cool piece of research because he does it with, you know, with the constraints of being on this one wire. So he has no power, he has no ground, he has to parasitically suck power off the flash. He can only change ones to zeros because he can only operate when he's got voltage from the flash, you know, signaling a one onwards to the BMC, and gets to the point where he can load a script and have it execute in Linux on the BMC, which is super cool research. And, you know, kind of feasible to implement within the space constraints of hardware, which, yeah, really cool work. I mean, it's one of those, you know, science fiction making things come true, you know, sort of stories. So, yeah, pretty cool.
Yeah, I understand, though, that it wasn't entirely always effective, this approach. Like, it worked during his demo, but I think I read somewhere that it was like 12% of the time or something he'd get what he was after.
Yeah, so I mean, he's got a bunch of areas where it's pretty dodgy. Like, he has to reconstruct the clock by watching the signals go past because he doesn't have access to a clock line. So it's pretty flaky. I think he said that in the software emulated version, it works about half the time. And on the real hardware, somewhere between 1 in 8 and 1 in 80 times, it'll actually work. So shonky as. But I mean, as a proof of concept of how you could do it, and if you were, you know, a nation state or someone who had good quality resourcing and engineering and time to perfect it, that, you know, that it was a viable technique. And one of the cool things about doing it, you know, like he describes, is that even if you pull the flash chips and replace them, or you instrument the flash chips to make sure it's loading the right firmware, it's still able to modify it, assuming that it's close enough, which is pretty cool.
No, it is really interesting. I don't know where I got 12% from. I'm going to have to sharpen up, Adam. I'm going to have to sharpen up as we progress into 2019. Another thing that happened, of course, was this group, apparently Dark Overlord. Dark Overlord. Ooh, spooky. They like owned some insurance company and were like trying to crowdfund Bitcoin to, for them to release this material. A bunch of conspiracy people got really excited, but I just sort of thought, like, I've always thought 9/11 conspiracy theories are a little bit weird, but, you know, what makes this one particularly weird is that, like, the insurance company was in on the conspiracy? How does that work? But anyway, they've been releasing documents and, they're about as boring as you can expect for insurance company documents.
Yeah, apparently they owned a law firm that advised some insurance companies or a couple of insurance companies that were involved in the insurance response to 9/11. And they, I think, initially tried to blackmail the insurance companies and the law firm in question, and then have been using this kind of public process to sort of pressure them to either pay up to stop the rest of the publication or just as some way to monetize what they've got. You kind of get the impression that they're just trying to make, scams of money, and who knows if there's anything even slightly interesting, which I suspect it probably isn't, but, conspiracy theory fools and their money probably soon parted.
Another one from CCC was someone has figured out how to make, like, a fake hand to fool, like, hand scanners that do vein authentication. I mean, it's cool, right? But, like, it's just cool. I don't know. This is blockbuster news, but it is pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of, biometric auth cat and mouse is always good fun to watch, because, gummy bears and wax and all the other amusing, fake hands and fake fingers and fake eyeballs and stuff. It's good, good fun, much more visual hacking than people are used to. In this particular case, the researchers were using, a regular SLR camera with the infrared filter removed, and then they were using that to take photos of the vein patterns in people's hands, which is what this particular biometric uses.
At a distance of up to 5 meters, which is cool.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, they're suggesting that you could do this, at a press conference or something, when someone famous is holding up their hand to wave or, waving like the Queen. You could take a photo, get the vein pattern, and then use that to break into their secret Swiss bank vault or something. Good movie hacking stuff, I suppose. And then they kind of print it out, make a wax, thing that fools the conductivity checks on it, slap it on the old palm scanner and job done. Yeah, pretty cool research.
Happy days. Now, look, a lot of people have been making hay out of Zerodium's latest shopping list, where they release, like, how much they're going to pay people for various bugs. I'm just going to say this right now. I think we all need to stop talking about Zerodium's shopping list because it is a marketing document and it's clearly just designed so that people will talk about it. I don't think it tells us anything about what they or their contemporaries are actually paying for these types of bugs. I think it's a completely meaningless document. And we do. And I've been one of the people who's talked about it in the past. And I don't know. I guess it's just kind of jumped the shark for me. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, Chuki Becker, the guy who runs Zerodium, is pretty good at kind of getting his name and his face and Zerodium's details out there, through this kind of thing. And I think you're right. Everyone's I have no doubt that they buy bugs and they do pay reasonable money for them, whether they're paying $2 million or whatever it is for an iOS remote and whether that means anything, as you say, probably not, right?
Ah, okay. I got a Twitter thread here that I found really interesting. El Chapo, the drug lord, is on trial in the United States at the moment and looks like his super encrypted network that he built to communicate with his other drug lord pals might have been, not so great because the guy who built it flipped for the FBI and they were basically like listening to all his calls for ages. But it's a really fascinating thread, this.
Yeah, apparently this particular guy, Christian Rodriguez, built this secure comm system for El Chapo and the rest of his drug cartel. Appears to be some kind of, VPN with overlay, voice over IP, and presumably some, client software on people's phones to use this particular mechanism. It doesn't sound super complicated from a technical perspective, but yeah, the FBI approached this guy and, initially posing as being another criminal gang that would like to procure his services. he ended up flipping. FBI got in a position where they could record all of the calls. Presumably they owned the thing that was doing the, you know, VoIP mediation service that was run by this guy. And yeah, they've got the call contents of, you know, some years of El Chapo doing his drug deals. And it's, yeah, not looking too good for him at the trial as a result.
No, it is not. I mean, you know, smoking gun meet El Chapo, basically, you know, where he's talking about. And these call logs do not reflect kindly on the Mexican police or, you know, state governments. So that's kind of interesting. But it is just, yeah, it is just interesting the way this stuff is all shaping up. You know, maybe he should have used Signal.
Well, I mean, in a way, yeah, right? I mean, you did not consider the whole threat model, right? They tried to solve one particular part of their threat model, i.e. interception on the wire by the carrier or whatever through regular lawful intercept, but they didn't consider the whole end-to-end threat model. And unfortunately, they are paying, well, fortunately in our case,
yeah, law-abiding
citizens. They ended up getting owned nevertheless because, you know, law enforcement's going to law enforce, right? And here they are.
Yeah. Signal, meanwhile, has said that it will not comply with Australia's new backdoor bill, which is kind of funny because, as far as I know, Signal do not operate in Australia.
No, and I mean, to be fair, they're kind of saying we can't cooperate with it, as opposed to, which, I mean, I guess you could argue semantics about, like, could modify their software perhaps, but no, I mean, they're saying that they're not in a position to be able to cooperate with those kinds of things, whether or not they would have to, or whether they're just kind of, you know, making a scene for the sake of being seen to be done so.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, you know, the Australian authorities expect that Signal is going to be cooperative, which is why I think they're trying to leave, you know, pull the lever on, you know, Samsung, Apple, Google, companies like that, right? So, you know, it makes for fun headlines, but it doesn't really mean anything. Oh, now this security company, this is like late last year. Apparently, like, this actual security company went around owning celebrity Twitter accounts and posting messages like, this person's been hacked by us, but don't worry because we're a totally legit security company. What the hell? And I thought, you know, is this like a security company in the same way that like Goatsy Security, Weave's thing is a security company? But no, they are actually a security company. I think they're British, are they?
Yeah, this company called Insignia, I think. We're doing this, and the funny thing is, like, there's not actually much in the way of hacking going on here. This what they're doing here is using Twitter's like ancient, you know, vestigial feature where you could SMS messages to Twitter, and they are spoofing the source phone number of SMS.
Even when I signed up for Twitter in like 2008, 2009, and I saw that as a feature, even then I was just thinking, but why?
Yeah, exactly. It's a terrible idea. But apparently a few people still had it turned on and they managed to find someone, you know, kind of sufficiently famous to make some noise for themselves. And yeah, they were just sending spoofed SMS without authorization from the people whose accounts they were posting from as some kind of, you know, a publicity thing, which...
Now, I'm not a lawyer, Adam. I'm not a lawyer. But I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that what they did in this case is almost certainly illegal.
Well, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much. So, yes, bad choice by them. And not even a good bug. Like, if it was a sweet bug, maybe, but you just kind of look like dicks.
Yeah, I concur. And, you know, it's just a weird thing to do, isn't it? Just a very, very weird thing to do.
Yeah. Twitter, for their part, say that they have, you know, that it was isolated to a particular carrier or some rubbish like that, which doesn't really make much sense. But yeah, just no hacking was done, just spoofing of SMS.
Now, look, you know, RSA is not really known for being the most, you know, technically amazing con. Although, you know, much to my surprise, you do get some pretty good talks at RSA. But at this year's conference, NSA is actually releasing a free reverse engineering tool, which is interesting.
Yeah, apparently it's somewhat comparable to IDA, the, you know, the reverse engineering tool that a lot of hackers will be familiar with. NSA apparently wrote this one in Java. It's been using it for some time. It's quite, you know, widely used there. And they're going to release it as open source because that's what the NSA does in the year 2019 AD, apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
people say it's cool. Quote, slower and buggier than IDA, but by open sourcing it, the NSA will benefit from free maintenance from the open source community. So maybe this is just, you know, they're trying to do more with less, leverage the crowd,
Well, you know, if your government's shut down, someone's got to maintain their code,
that's right? You know, hey, maybe that's why. Maybe they should just open source everything. So there you go. Now, look, speaking of open source tool releases, we've had this thing pop out which aims to curb BGP hijacks. I haven't had much of a chance to have a look at it, but what did you think of it? It's called Artemis, and it is, as I say, an open source thing. This thing is like, what does it do? It alerts on BGP route hijacks?
So yeah, this is a set of software that you, as a network operator, you run in your environment. You explain to it what your normal network looks like. You provide it, here's a list of prefixes, here's how I advertise them, here's my upstream ASs, and then it uses BGP feeds from a number of different public looking glass services, you know, the ones that are already in existence, and then attempts to spot, you know, BGP hijacking and other weird, you know, path insertions and things going on in the wider internet, and then either A, alert you to them, and B, optionally also respond automatically to them. You know, whether or not any big network operator is game to let a piece of software just kind of change how their things are announced, I'm not quite sure. But at the very minimum, you know, having an ISP be able to, or a network operator being able to detect, you know, in near real time that something weird is going on, and then have some push button options for mitigating it, does seem like a pretty good thing to do.
It does, and it strikes me as a better approach than trying to PKI BGP, right? Like trying to DNSSEC BGP, which, you know, you look at all of those schemes and they're just not, nah.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, in the ideal world, we would PKI BGP, but I mean, we don't live in the ideal world. And detection is pretty good, right? If you know what's going on, then, you know, you can at least react to it a lot quicker. And I think that's really the key thing here, is to reduce the, you know, the amount of time until the operator knows that something weird is going on, you know, down to seconds or minutes, instead of relying on third parties to spot something weird, or other, you know, commercial monitoring services. So, yeah, good option if you're a network operator. Go and have a look at it. You know, I imagine the thing that's challenging here is you do have to explain to this what normal looks like, and that may be difficult you know, if you have a network environment that's particularly dynamic anyway. But, you know, I'm sure there are some people for whom it would be a useful thing.
Yeah, I could just tell you having flashbacks to your ISP days then when you were saying that.
ISP normal is, yeah.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I've heard the stories, not just from you, don't worry. moving on, we got another story here. ZDNet is carrying this story, but it's based on a research paper against some new side channel attacks. What are these attacks, Adam? These are attacks, side channel attacks, that are now enable you to fiddle with cache to elicit information. Like, what are these? They're very complicated things.
Yeah, so obviously cache and side channel attacks in general have been getting a whole bunch of you know, steam lately, and there's a bit of kind of, you know, academic rigor beginning to arise about how you think about them and what that kind of means. You know, lots of people are writing a lot of papers about side channels, and this particular set of research by a bunch of, you know, it's you know, quite good research by a bunch of different academics is talking about using cache timing attacks against operating system page table caches, which are you know, kind of a construct that is implemented similarly by all of the mainstream operating systems to map main memory out onto disk, and, you know, for swap and disk caching and that kind of thing. This particular set of attacks basically involves extracting timing information about what other processes on the same system are loading from disk. And by being able to control the state of the page cache to be able to then figure out what's going on. So fundamentally, these are timing attacks, and they've implemented a few things on top of that, like covert channels, for example, between processes that are inside some degree of sandboxing, for example. But in terms of actual, I mean, attacks in the style of Meltdown Inspector, you know, these are much kind of less useful, I guess. There's going to be some proposed changes by Microsoft and by the Linux kernel maintainers to try and adjust how the page tables are used to mitigate this particular set of attacks. But I mean, fundamentally, they are, you know, they're interesting in advancing the art of attacking caches in general, and page table caches are particularly, you know, important one to attack because it's very similar across operating systems. But I mean, in the end, these are timing attacks rather than anything that's going to, you know, warrant the kind of headlines we saw about, oh my God, they're remote, which is, you know, the scenarios they're describing remotely here are covert channels as opposed to, you know, information leaking one way.
Okay. Well, we're going to link through to that research paper in this week's show notes, so if you're interested, you can check that out. Now we're going to talk about the Marvel Avastar Wi-Fi chipset. Is that what we're talking about now?
I guess that's what we're talking about. There was this presentation at the always kind of scary good Zero Nights conference in Russia about a guy who had done a bunch of reverse engineering work on a particular Wi-Fi system on chip, the Marvel one that you mentioned, that's in use by a bunch of devices.
Yeah, like PlayStation 4, PlayStation 4 Pro, Microsoft Surface, Surface Pro, Surface Laptop, Xbox One, Samsung Chromebook, and some smartphones.
Yeah, so these are pretty commonly used Marvel Wi-Fi socks, and the guy's talk is kind of broken into setting up an environment to reverse engineer the firmware of these systems on a chip, and then using that rig that he's built to then go and fuzz and find bugs. And he's got a bunch of interesting bugs in the firmware of these devices. One particular example he called out is remote code exec onto the system on the chip during the Wi-Fi network scanning process. So with no user interaction, automatically the device is going to keep a list of the network the networks that are in the local neighborhood of the device, and in this case this guy can lead this through to code exec on the device.
But from there where, now as I understand it, you told me this earlier, from what I understand, you can then actually use some bugs in the drivers, right, and then propagate on.
Well, so I mean, once you're on the SOC, obviously you've got a bunch of capability in terms of being able to interact with the hardware. If I'm not 100% sure, say, if there's DMA options or other hardware level things you could do to interact with main memory or whatever else from this point of view. One of the devices he used as an example in his talk was the Valve Steam Link that people use for in-home game streaming, which is kind of Linux under the hood. And he appears to, and I haven't seen the actual presentation, I'm going off the slide deck, and he appears to then, like, once he's got code exec on the SOC, go ahead and find some bugs in the Linux driver for this wireless device, and then exploit those from his position on the wireless chip. So use the wireless chip to exploit the code exec bug in the driver from the chip towards the Linux kernel to get code exec on the host OS, which... that's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool, because it's just, it's one of those zero interaction, just, get near a device and own it. It is cool stuff, right?
Yeah, and I mean, the talk really has a bunch of great details about how he built the test rigs and the fuzzing process and some of the challenges that go along with doing this, actually doing it, as opposed to just kind of talking about it in general. So that's, those talks that document the journey that someone goes on to find these kinds of bugs are often more useful than the individual bugs themselves. Mm. Definitely worth reading if you're into this kind of, fairly detailed reverse engineering and bug hunting. And yeah, just cool.
Can you imagine rolling incident response and then discovering that this was the point of entry? You would seriously just say, that's not fair. You can't do that.
Well, I think at that point you go like, fair cop, you got me. You can have your shell. Good job.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. It's like, what do you do about that, right? Like, because, this can't be the only place bugs like that exist. And anyway. So, I was saying on Twitter, Rode Microphone sent me some free stuff to play around with. And they've got a new podcasting rig, and this comes with pads. I'm going to be using this when I'm in Brazil. But it's got pads where I can play like sound effects and stuff. And I've got a sad trombone button. I also have an internet weapon button, but I also have a sad trombone button. And Adam, I'm disappointed I'm not using this equipment today, because if I was, I would definitely use the sad trombone button for this story, the last story in this week's news, which is this Windows DHCP client remote. This is horrible.
Oh, dear, yeah. So Microsoft have a bug in their DHCP client whereby an attacker can, by sending a malformed DHCP server response to the client, gain remote code exec in the DHCP client.
Wah, 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 wah.
Yeah, exactly. This is just, I mean, we've seen other people have bugs in the DHCP clients. Like, we had one in the ISC one with Shellshock on Linux. We've seen a few other Mac had a bug. But DHCP clients are just a place that, it's a pretty simple protocol. Like, surely there's not that much to screw up. And this is like Windows 10, right? We're not talking like XP or, some end of life, rubbish Windows. Like, this is, Windows Server, at least Windows Server Core, Windows 10 on 32-bit and x64 and on ARM, which, not really ideal.
You just have to imagine a really good sad trombone effect in there. But Adam, on that note, mate, that is it for this week's news. It's great to have you back on deck, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, no, it's nice. It's nice to be back, and you know, I'm looking forward to owning a bunch of things via DHCP or something for the rest of the year. And yeah, we'll see what other bugs come our way.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at some recent security news. Big thanks to him for that. And yeah, as I just mentioned, I am traveling to Brazil next week to visit with Mrs. Business's family. We'll be over there for a while, actually. But yeah, the only reason I mention it is it means next week's show is going to run a day early just due to our travel arrangements. Okay, on to this week's sponsor interview now with Scott Schefferman of Cylance. Scott is the Director of Global Services with Cylance, and he's here to talk about how MITRE's attack matrix is informing their approach to, you know, services and even product design decisions. Well, really everyone's design decisions, because, you know, MITRE attack has become an extremely influential document. But as you'll hear, there is a risk that people are going to start making claims about how their products give you full coverage against MITRE attack and, you know, that sort of bullshit. So there is some Cylance product talk in this interview, but honestly, I found this one pretty interesting and interesting enough to let it run a little bit longer than a regular sponsor interview. So here's Scott Schefferman of Cylance talking about MITRE's attack framework. I do hope you enjoy it.
It's one of those things that's becoming a new kind of a, you know, lexicon for everybody in the industry. And I don't think it really matters where you kind of sit in the cybersecurity industry. It seems to be coming to the forefront in terms of how we describe attacks, TTPs. It even obviously plays into the attribution side of this whole industry. And then obviously, you know, Cylance, we have professional services as well. And so it also plays into how let's say a consultant might articulate findings and messaging to their customer.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because like a lot of pen testers I know have been all over it for quite a few years. Stefan Jeanette over at Attack IQ, they're huge proponents of the attack framework and have been for some years. But it does really feel like it's getting a bit of traction as a useful framework for pretty much everyone, right? Like almost the way standards documents for blue teams, you know, sort of emerged longer ago. It feels like the attack framework now is just something that so many different organizations can get something out of.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm actually from San Diego, so I've known Stefan for a while over at Attack IQ, and he's absolutely wonderful. I love what he's created, and it is moving the ball forward. And that's actually a great representation of how to move the ball forward given a framework. And also, you know, just briefly say hats off to MITRE as well. My background is, you know, prior to the vendor space here at Cylance and FireEye before that, I spent about 17 years in DoD circles, intelligence community circles, in the cyber realm. And MITRE have always been kind of a lean forward. They'll invest early into a framework or a concept, and then lo and behold, everybody is able to adopt it and use it, and you'll see it play out in things like DISA and NSA kind of guidance around cybersecurity and that kind of thing. So hats off to them again for doing this for us. And I think, you know, it's taken a while, but I think it is finally coming into its own in terms of a common reference.
Yeah, it just feels like the last year in particular, it's hit that mark of being, as you say, a common reference. But, you know, I'm curious, you know, you work for a company that makes anti-malware software. So, you know, how does the MITRE attack framework actually inform what, you know, a company like Cylance does?
Right. So, it, you know, if you look at our core technology, right, like you said, anti-malware, that's been a story for the last 3 or 4 years. But then you'd also have to tack onto that story now with what we call Cylance Optics, which is the best way I like to describe it is our answer to EDR and our answer to the threat actors themselves. With the advent of fileless malware and all the kind of lateral movement techniques that we're seeing, you know, the optics component of this, or the post malware execution component, if you refer to the, you know, the generic kill chain, is really what optics is focused on. So MITRE attack feeds into that story as well. If I backtrack and just kind of answer your original question about anti-malware, and if you think about all the tactics of MITRE attack, which is basically your kill chain kind of you know, blown up, if you will, execution is a core aspect of a tactic, right? Most, at one point a few years ago, we said that whatever, as an industry, 95% of attacks are coming in through things like spear phishing and malware execution, and that's shifted in the last couple of years. And I think partly the reason why, like you said, attack is kind of taken off as well is because attack helps us describe a lot more than just malware execution and everything that comes kind of after that, proverbially after execution. So
no, that makes sense, right? Because like, I mean, it's you're going to be pretty limited. You're going to be touching some pretty limited space on that matrix just from a pre-execution, you know, scanning point of view, right? But when it comes to, you know, EDR stuff, it makes a lot more sense. I'm curious though, you know, you describe optics as your answer to EDR, not actually not EDR. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, it kind of depends on who I'm sitting across from, right? But is it our EDR? Absolutely. Like if, does Cylance have an EDR solution? Sure, it's called optics, right? So if that's the question, that's the answer. But it's actually also benefiting from the fact that it's a very new kind of platform and philosophy that we're bringing to the EDR space is a good way to put it. So it's not your legacy or traditional EDR. It's much more about getting ahead of a kill chain and interjecting that kill chain in real time as it's playing out, rather than kind of collecting detection, sending it to the cloud, overlaying it and enriching it, doing correlation in the cloud, doing analysis as a security analyst, and then saying, oh, something bad has happened, right? And now I need to kind of go back, pivot and hunt and pivot across that bad thing that I've identified through cloud intelligence. Optics doesn't do that. Optics, well, it can do that, but Optics, what the core philosophy is the ability to actually detect something happening on the endpoint in kind of at machine speed, because it's an answer to the most common threats that we saw, like last summer with WannaCry and NotPetya, these kind of threats that move at machine speed, that are fully automated, if you will, and do all their propagation, lateral movement, even exfiltration or destruction kind of autonomously and in real time.
Okay, so like two things. First of all, every time you say kill chain, we have to send a check for $10 to Lockheed Martin because it's their registered trademark.
Fair enough.
Second of all,
I've been playing kill chain for 17 years, so you got to forgive me on that. It's a great point.
Second of all, it's interesting hearing you say that this is new and like, couching EDR in terms of like being legacy EDR and talking about, you know, something that will actually get involved on the endpoint. I mean, you're not the only company making software that does this sort of thing. The thing that I find strange about this is that really we're going back to a complicated, you know, what complicated AV software was doing 10 years ago. I mean, companies like Symantec were doing very fiddly things on the endpoints in terms of generic detections. Companies like Sophos were doing that. I mean, I'm not poo-pooing the approach here, but I mean, aren't we returning really to an approach that has been around for a while when we talk about interdicting suspicious behavior on an endpoint?
It's a great question. If you think about how we formally used to phrase like what we did with Cylance Protect, not being behavior or heuristic based, rather being a static understanding of what a file is or isn't in the known universe of good and bad files. Well, that's the Protect story. The Optics story in part does, in fact, as you just said, go back in time to if I see this kind of behavior and I have this kind of context, is it in fact malicious and do I need to alert on it or is there a way I can kind of block it from doing something next? So in part, absolutely to answer your question. But then beyond that and kind of the lean forward aspect of what I was beginning to describe there at the last answer was that we're looking to also build an agent that is, you know, fully microservices built. In other words, we can dev extremely fast and plug into that architecture extremely fast. And as a result, we'll be able to plug in what Cylance does really well, which is the maths, right? So we, you know, and unlike just a heuristic signature or a hard rule, we're going to be able to plug things around identity, plug things in around machine learning, able to detect like one-liners and two-liners throughout the entire, what you might call universe of potential ways you can conduct a one-liner. Detect that, understand that it's malicious, and then block that process before it even completes execution, right? So that the child process never gets to spawn. So we're trying to push it. You know, this.
No, I get it. I'm with you. But this feels to me like like building on prior work, right? And as I say, it's not just Cylance doing this, but it's like everyone's couching it in these terms of being, you know, absolutely revolutionary. And it's like, no, we've had software like this for quite a while. Like we're making it better, which is what you're supposed to do in technology.
It's much of the same in a lot of ways. For example, if you to your point, let's emphasize your point first. in optics, we have something called a context analysis engine, right? CAE engine. This engine is actually just looking at static rule detection, and then an automated or autonomous response that can happen right after that, in, you know, kind of at machine speed, right? To actually stop the kill chain rather than just detect and alert upon it. But the thing is, like, those rules are what you might, if you look at the whole universe of MITRE ATT&CK, right, to bring it back to ATT&CK, you have hundreds and hundreds of techniques, right, within whatever 11 or a dozen tactics. And all these techniques don't even account for the actual full universe of what's out there. They account for what we've already seen and what we know and what we understand and such. But what optics is trying to do with context analysis engine is to say, look, these are the ones that matter most in the context of what we've seen for the last 5-6 years doing incident response, penetration testing, and compromise assessments. You know, I've done thousands of compromise assessments. So what we know from the wild is that things like pre-execution of malware, hello, back to protect, is very important in the overall kill chain of whether or not you can actually get ahead of an attack right before exfiltration. Also, we know things like privilege escalation and credential compromise are probably a close second number two. Like, that's probably the most other important thing to stop in a kill chain, right? So knowing this kind of thing, it's really important to kind of say, look, we've prioritized optics where we are using static rules with content rules to say, look, these are the most important things. We want to have extremely high or, you know, low noise and high confidence that if you see alert like this hit, you have enough confidence in that rule to allow for an autonomous action to even happen. And that is a really big difference because, you know, current endpoint technology, and yes, I'm fully wearing my sales hat here in spite of myself, right? But current technology does a good job of kind of detecting all the things and in so doing, creating tons of noise and relying on an analyst to know how to triage that, you know, through that noise to get to signal, et cetera, right? What we're trying to do is say, look, when you get an alert, it's so high confidence because we have additional context around it or we're applying machine learning to it, that it's so high confidence you can allow for an autonomous action to kill the child process, right? To take, or in the case of identity, if I have a user identity process, right? And that process has gone from a human belly button known process to a machine process, like during NotPetya, when it's taking advantage of a user level process to propagate, I want to know with high confidence the moment that process goes from a human owned belly button process to one that is a machine, an evil machine automated process, right? It's been injected into, et cetera. And then if I have enough confidence, why don't I immediately challenge that user with step up auth or a capture or some kind of a second factor? So I know that the human is actually there and on the keyboard, right?
Let's start with that. Actually, yeah. No, I get it. That's a cool idea.
Yeah, so that we call that silence persona, and you'll see that manifest over the next couple quarters here. But that's an example of silence applying machine learning by looking at a number of variables, and additionally, what you might call what we human analysts call context, building all that around into a meta model that understands with high confidence when a process is no longer a process and it is also evil.
It's funny, right?
Because like, it's evil.
There's just a theme emerging, right, among the vendors that I speak to, for this podcast. Like, you know, they're advertisers. Let's be honest, right? But you know, there are insights to be gleaned, and it feels like the race in 2019 is about, like, you know, alerts are dead, long live reports, right? And long live, you know, post incident reports when actions have been taken. It just really feels like, you know, that success benchmark for security technology was detect something suspicious, flag an alert that someone may or may not follow up on. You know, that's become redundant thinking. And now it's very much either take an action or correlate against other events and produce a rock solid report indicating something has happened.
Or not just a report, but I'll even push it further and say, before there's any kind of report gen and you have a high confidence detection, do you have enough confidence in it in the context of it being malicious, right? And also in the context of understanding that you don't have a false positive at play, so much so that you can allow an autonomous action to take place in response to that at a microsecond level, such that you can literally kill a process before this child process is spawned. So if you take like a PowerShell living in, let's say, XLS, you know, context, or living in a Word docker, right? And it's been injected into, and it now wants to call download, right? And it the second the, you know, ML sees that download process, machine learning sees that, it knows that it's malicious, and then literally will stop the process before the download connection even happens. Like before, you might see it print the screen, but you won't actually see the process be running in memory by the time you go find it to kill it, because it's already been killed. And even though we're dealing a microsecond kind of universe right now in this conversation, the impacts are pretty significant, because now you don't see everything that happens after that in an automated attack. You don't see the lateral moving. You don't see PowerShell going to a second host and then
okay,
all this
man,
stuff
come on, one more time. Say it, and I'll write the check to Lockheed.
There you go.
Say it, because now you're avoiding saying it, and it's weird.
I can't do it. Yeah, so. Speaking of Lockheed Kill Chain, there was like an advanced version of it towards the end, right before MITRE ATT&CK was kind of implemented and created. And it had like two loops on it, and it described like a lifecycle process. It wasn't just
yeah,
a
I remember it. It was
model.
Good work, right? And the thing, yeah. The way that they flipped it all up is that they made it like a trademarkable thing, so that other people couldn't even use the term. So now we have MITRE, which is great. But yeah, God, way to go, Lockheed Marketing! You ruined your own marketing.
You know, one of the things that's interesting around marketing, and since you've brought it up, and it's kind of near and dear of late, is if you look at what MITRE ATT&CK is and isn't, right, and what it's good for and what it's not necessarily good for, you're starting to see that it's on the precipice of being hugely misunderstood and abused by marketing and advertising kind of efforts. And some of that is inevitable, natural kind of evolution, how marketing kind of lags technology in any given Sunday. But at the same time, you're seeing starting to see vendors come out and say, like, we have what you might call full MITRE ATT&CK coverage.
Oh, man. You know, you're making a really, really good point there. And it's something that I hadn't thought of, but I should have, right? because, yeah, you're going to start to see people doing that, right? Like, that will be a standard marketing play. And then it's going to be up to people to sort of determine on their own whether or not those claims stack up. And it's just, you know, another more shit to do, right?
Well, I'll give you an example. So let's say you're talking about like persistence and using like a registry run key to have persistence, right? You're bad software, you're bad actor, you're going to do this thing, right? And, you know, the MITRE ATT&CK framework would call that the technique, quote unquote, a T1060 amongst, you know, hundreds of techniques. And if you were to go to a vendor, let's say an endpoint, like Cylance or anyone else for that matter, and say, do you have coverage, quote unquote, for T1060? If that vendor technology can demonstrate one case where they do see a registry persistence setting set, they can then go to marketing and say, yes, checkmark, we have coverage for that. Hmm. But what it doesn't tell you is probably the most important part of understanding all of this, which is it doesn't tell you the other seven different ways you could use registry settings. So if they're using something like, oh, I don't know, like runs registry, right? Which is something that Fin7 and Plain T and a couple other adversaries are known to use. And you're using that as your test case, as an independent testing authority or whatever in the future, to see if a vendor or a set of vendors have coverage for it. You might get five positives and one negative result. But that one negative result might have really good coverage for the other seven ways to
yeah.
set registry settings.
Look, I can already see it now that we're going to see websites with a check mark that says MITRE ATT&CK compliant or something like that. That's a horrible thing. Like, you're 100% right. This is something that's going to happen. It's something I didn't realize until now. You know, I didn't think of that, and that's really depressing. So thanks a lot, Scott. But look, Scott Schefferman, we're going to wrap it up right now. It's been a pleasure to chat to you. Our first sponsor interview back into 2019. It's been great to talk to you. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Hector, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That was Scott Schefferman of Cylance there. Big thanks to him for that. And big thanks to Cylance for sponsoring the Risky Business Podcast in 2019. And that is it for this week's show. I'll be back in 6 days with the next weekly episode. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.